Well, as Nassim was just saying, dark energy may not exist. As a matter of fact, now a story breaking in the United Kingdom that the concept of dark energy was created by cosmologists to fit Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity into reality after modern space telescopes discovered that the universe was not behaving as it should. Well, now these two scientists, Blake Temple and Joel Smoller, mathematicians at the University of California and the University of Michigan, believe that they've come up with a whole new set of calculations that allow for all the sums to add up without the need for this controversial substance. The research, of course, could change the way astronomers view the composition of our universe. Nassim has been telling us this all along. We'll be back with phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Nassim, you might agree with these two scientists, these mathematicians, that they say, too, that it looks like dark energy may not exist.
Yes. Like I was saying earlier, when your equation is only able to predict 4% or 2% of what you're seeing, you have a choice. You can start inventing all kinds of new stuff, or you can look at your equation and figure out where you made the error. And, I think the latter is the preferred approach, and I'm glad that others are finding that out.
If you had an opportunity to talk with Albert Einstein, what would you talk with him about?
If I could talk to Einstein, I would definitely talk to him about black holes, because his equations is the equation that actually, predicted the existence of black holes, the possibility of black holes. But when it was rendered at this time, he didn't like that answer. He actually wanted to get away from singularity and black holes. He thought that made his equations invalid at that level. And, in general, most physicists thought so too. But they said, that part of the curvature, that part of the result, we're going to ignore, and we're just going to take the weak curvature, because they thought, we'll never find such an animal. That probably doesn't exist. It's just a function of the math. And then eventually we start to find evidence of black holes in the cosmological world, in the center of galaxies and quasars and all this stuff. And then it's like, wait a minute, there is really black holes out there. They do exist. But Einstein was long gone by then. So I think that if Einstein would have looked deeper into that possibility of black holes, of singularities, I think he could have solved unification if he would have applied those to the atomic world. But you see, it was so unreasonable to even think that those things existed in the cosmological world at the time, never mind applying that to the atomic level. Even today when I talk to people about atoms being mini black holes, it's kind of shocking.
To the phones we go. You ready?
Yes.
Ann Arbor, Michigan, we go. Rod, get us started. Go ahead, Rod.
Yes. Nassim, I have two questions. The first is, when you talk about infinite division of space, doesn't this conflict with the Planck volume limit? What is it, 10 to the minus 99th cubic centimeters?
No, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters is the Planck's limit.
That's the length limit. The volume limit would be...
The volume, yes. Well, in the case, what my theory says is that the Planck's limit is actually, one of the limits. It's one of the boundaries. It's the boundary that defines, our world viewed from our scale.
Oh, I see.
But that there's actually further divisions and that there are possibilities. And actually, there's data that just came out last week from Hubble Telescope pictures that starts to debate the validity of that limit being the end. There's evidence that actually there might be resolution past the Planck's limit.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh.
So look it up. It just came out last few weeks.
That makes a lot of sense, then. And my other question is, are you familiar with Roger Penrose's ideas about the connection between quantum mechanics and consciousness through quantum coherence taking place in the microtubules and living cells? And if you know about this, what do you think about it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think Penrose did a wonderful work in there, in that field with the microtubules and the relationship to the twister algebra. And actually, much of what he did is very compatible with what I did. And I, you know, if you go to my website on the research link, you'll find papers about that. One that was published, you know, a year or so ago, and
really, I mean, on that subject.
Yes.
Really.
Yeah. Well, on the subject of the solution to my equation having a relationship with the different algebras, and you know, not directly the microtubule and the relationship to consciousness, but certainly in the relationship between these algebras. Now, you know, interestingly, in one of my papers, I show a scaling law, and that scaling law has, you know, a relationship between the frequency of systems and their size, their radius, and I plot on it from the Planck's distance, from extremely small to the universal size, and I plot all the objects in between, and they line up nicely along a gradual expansion line. And interestingly, when you take the microtubule, their size and their frequency, and you plot them on there, they bisect that line between the Planck's distance, billions of times smaller than the atom, and the universal size, like almost in the middle. So it's like biology is like the connection between the two. It's kind of almost perfectly in the middle between the two. So I think that's very interesting. It's we're part of that network of information between the large and the small.
Next up, we go to Phoenix, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Keith, it's your turn.
Hey there, George. Nice talking to you again.
Thanks, Keith.
A very nice show. I was just wondering, is that dark matter, is it the explanation for the weight of the universe?
The dark matter and dark energy, mm-hmm. Well, dark matter certainly is because when you look at galaxies, mm-hmm. You know, and you look at the way they behave, there's a whole bunch of mass missing for it to behave that way relative to the way the equation should have it behave.
Has anyone thought about life being that mass?
About life?
Yes, like human beings on other planets or beings on other planets being that mass that's missing?
Unless they were very massive beings.
If you have trillions upon trillions of these smaller beings, wouldn't they equal some sort of mass?
Well, even if they were pretty massive beings, like if they ate a lot of fast food, relative to the mass of a galaxy, it would be trivial. But what I'm saying is that actually, you know, this feedback from the vacuum, this vacuum energy, this fundamental superfluids, superconductive structure we call space, is actually the source of that energy.
I have one more question.
Sure, go ahead.
I was just wondering what your thought would be on life existing, you know, other than in a flesh form, more in a maybe metallic form, say mercury for blood, water is mercury, different, just a different structure. But
different life
still,
form. Yeah.
Different life form, but still being able to exist with just different forms of metal, per se, other than this flesh structure.
Right, meaning like on other planets and so on?
Yeah, I was just wondering if life could exist, if you think life could exist maybe in a
completely different form,
completely different structure.
Or would it have to look exactly like us?
Yeah, exactly.
No, I believe that life can exist in many different forms because if this vacuum structure is the source of all the information, it self-organizes, it always uses the same function at all the scales, but it will manifest differently depending on the local environment so that it can survive even. And, you know, we keep finding that. We keep going to new places like deep, deep in the ocean and so on and finding life there where we thought life could not exist because nature is able to do things, our organized systems so that it can produce life in many different ways that surprises us. And it's almost like a Darwinian evolutional theory of the physics of creation. It takes the concept that systems adapt to their local environment and brings it to the physics of the universe. And so, yeah, I believe that life probably emerges in many different ways. And so depending if a planet has oxygen and nitrogen and what the quantities of these gases are, or if it's completely different, maybe you have beings that can breed completely different things. If you look even at our earlier evolution, when we were monocellular system, oxygen was the pollutant of the day, and we almost got wiped out. It was almost extinction on our planet because we were producing way too much oxygen, and all the monocellular systems were dying until they were in competition, until they started to collaborate and produce a multicellular system that eventually could breed oxygen, and then all of a sudden it flourished again. And I think, in one way, our civilization is learning that lesson, how to collaborate.
Let's go next to Toronto, Canada, on the international line. Steve, hi.
Hey, how's it going, George?
Good.
My question, I have two. One of them is what the guest's thoughts are on the problem of evil in our world. And the other one is regarding viruses. What do you thought of the theory that because viruses aren't actually alive, and if you look at them like a picture of a virus under a very powerful microscope, that they actually look like little machines. So I wondered what he thought about the theory that viruses could actually be nanotechnology from a previous civilization of Earth. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thank you. Wow, those are interesting questions. About evil, I fundamentally don't believe in evil. I believe that there's just confusion. There's just, there's so much that a being has to overcome when they come in our world. Our world has a tendency to be quite violent. I mean, even the first few minutes of birth in our modern civilization, if a child is birthed in a hospital, can be quite, traumatic, and all the environmental issues we're facing and all this stuff and the difficulties that a being can undergo very early in their childhood in our society. I think that's what produces what we call evil. I don't believe that children are born fundamentally evil, but that actually it's a product of our confusion and our level of society. And I think hopefully that will change in the near future, that is very, very much improving now. I think there's just different levels, different gradients of awareness. And that's what makes up the difference between a Buddha and Hitler. I think, as far as viruses go, I think viruses are a natural entity. They're crucial to the evolution of our biology. They produce they reinforce the system so that the challenge to those systems demands that they set up new networks of information to defend themselves and reinforce the structure and so on. In one way, you could look at viruses as the way the universe learns about itself. It's by system being challenged that we learn. I mean, we can see it even in our own life, you know. The challenges we encounter are a great opportunity to learn about ourselves.
Okay, next up, let's go to Dayton, Ohio, east of the Rockies. Donna, go ahead.
My question is, in more simpler terms, is it what you're talking about the universe, what you put basically out into the universe is what you is going to come back to you, so what we would call karma?
Karma. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was described in many different ways in different cultures, and karma is one of them. It's that this concept of feedback, that there's a relationship between what you feed to the vacuum and what's going to come back to you. And so, you know, in more modern spiritual groups, they call it creating your own reality and so on. I just want to warn on that it's important to realize that, you know, when you feed information and intend something and give it to the universe, or what I call the vacuum energy, then, you know, it's modified by everything else, because the vacuum or the structure of the universe is self-organizing everything, so it has to coordinate so that there is a consensus reality. If everybody created their own reality and that was exactly what they created, nobody would meet. We would all be in our own reality and there would be no consensus. So there's actually, you know, you have to understand that, yes, you're creating your reality and reality is creating you. It's a feedback. There's a dance, and both sides of the equation are crucial.
Crucial indeed. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Nancy in North Hollywood, California. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi there.
Hi.
First-time caller, a long-time listener.
Good to have you with us.
Thanks. I always wanted to say that. Basically, my birthday is on August 12th, and every year there's that Perseids meteor shower, and recently I've been trying to research that, and I'm wondering if there's a correlation between, you know, what it really means behind having your birthday on the time of this explosive meteor shower every year, and I can't find any research about that delves into that.
Well, you know, that's a good thought. I'm not sure what it means. I mean, maybe that you have a sparkly personality. I wouldn't know, but if you're asking if I believe that astrology has any meaning, I would say that it most likely does. And I mean that loosely, because, you know, in this concept that I'm bringing forward, everything is connected, everything is entangled, all protons are entangled. So, you know, the position of planets and the position of stars and the position of the solar system and what's happening inside it when you're born has probably an effect on who you are and what you do.
We'll be back with final phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Mark Stavish joins us, Between the Gates, Lucid Dreaming, and Astral Projection. Looking forward to that. When we come back, we'll take final phone calls with our special guest tonight, scientist Nassim Haramein, next on Coast to Coast AM. What's the one answer, Nassim, that you have not had answered yet about what you've done, the universe, that you would love answered?
Well, how to have an easy long-term relationship. You know, that, I think that is the biggest challenge that one can encounter. It certainly keeps me on my toes.
Sure does. Well, if you can get through that, then everything else is simple, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. You know, I can solve some of the most complex equations, but certainly, you know, keeping a beautiful connection in an intimate relationship is a challenge, and it's a great opportunity.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What do other scientists say about some of your theories? Do they agree with you? They fight with you? What do they say?
Well, you know, certainly earlier on, you know, some 15 years ago, there was a lot of resistance. It was very difficult. And I walked out of a physics conference in some cases very disappointed and, in tears. And, you know, there's been a lot of challenges. It's been very difficult as well because I'm an independent. I'm not part of any large institution or anything like that. And so it has, you know, getting published and all this has been challenging as well. But it's slowly changing. And that's what I'm amazed how fast it actually is changing in the last few years. And there's a very... There's an openness that's occurring and a transformation that's occurring in the physics world that's really encouraging. But, yeah, there's been plenty of challenges. And less and less now that I've written more and more papers and I've flushed out many of the math and the physics necessary, I've got much more positive response and actually a lot of excitement. And my last paper winning this award, the best paper award in this conference I just went to, and, you know, it all is coming together, and it's changing very beautifully at this point. However, you know, earlier on it was very difficult and painful. You know, because it takes time for things to change. It takes time for people to accept new ideas, and it's understandable. I mean, people have worked on their theory for, in some cases, 40 years, and they're not just gonna, you know, change their ideas overnight. As well, you know, in very advanced physics and unified theory and all this, generally the people involved are physicists that are very well seasoned. They've been there for a long time. They're typically in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and so on. So, you know, I was 30-some years old coming in saying I had a unified field theory and all this. And so, you know, they were wondering why is the... you know, busboy, you know, showing up at physics conference. You know?
Einstein was almost the same, wasn't he? He started all this at a young age.
He did. He started all this at a young age. Like me, had difficulties at school. You know, like me, he was an independent when he was a third class clerk at the patent office.
That's right.
And, you know, a lot of people, you know, had difficulties with all of that when he first published and all this. And it took him a long time to get recognized. So, you know, but the thing is that typically in many cases in history, new ideas that were found to have some validity and some potential came from independent thinkers.
All right, let's go to our final calls now. We'll go to David, first-time caller in Santa Ana, California. Hey, David, go ahead.
Hi, George. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Thank you. Mr. Harriman, I was curious about, you tied some of the work you did to ancient civilizations and ancient religions and the idea of the singularity. But also, I'm noticing what you're talking about can be connected to very current modern mainstream ideas, like take the book The Power of Now, for example. In that book, they're describing to us that from any current moment, we have in front of us infinite possibilities of new moments. And so this is almost identical to what you described. And I'm curious if you have any ideas about, is this by accident or are we arrived at the conclusion from different directions?
Yeah, actually, yeah, very good observation there. You know, if this is really the way the universe works, it you know, we should be able to find it in our, you know, in our ancient culture, in our modern culture, in our philosophy, in the philosophies of our best thinkers around the world. And that's what you're actually describing. Yeah, absolutely. This is why we're starting to find it in many, many different publications around the world, this concept of this infinite potential and so on. And what I've done basically is I've expressed that in a way that it's described mathematically and in the physics and the mechanics of it. Just like I said earlier, you know, like my equation shows that there's that the vacuum seemed to entangle all protons, meaning that all protons are connected through this structure of the vacuum, which makes it all one. And all of a sudden, the meaning of it's all one or we're all one has a foundation in the physics and the mechanics of it, so that these concepts are philosophical concepts are all of a sudden given a physical meaning and how it's really happening. What is, you know, why are we all one, and why do we have infinite possibilities in each moment, and so on, and that kind of completes the picture, and as well opens up the field of engineering and technology that can align to these fundamental philosophical understanding and actually apply them, because now we understand the mechanics of it.
Okay, next up we go to Bellevue, Illinois on the wildcard line. Jim, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just have two questions. I have the first question is, do you think that there is a possibility there is another form of gravity that is responsible for dark matter? And do you also think that it's possible there is a coact or subdimensional coact that is causing this possible equation? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. Those are really good, all these questions.
They're like physicists all by themselves, aren't they?
Yes, very good. You know, you can see that there's more and more really good thinkers out there. You know, I think that I don't think there's another form of gravity. I just think that we haven't completely understood gravity. And you know, most physicists will admit to that. We don't quite know what gravity is. I mean, Einstein said it was the curvature of space-time, but that doesn't quite tell us everything. And, you know, the dark matter issue, you know, as far as gravity goes, I think that when we start to understand, I'll make it really simple. When we start to understand that a galaxy is a function of the space, meaning imagine that the galaxy is actually a pattern in the space. Take all the stars out, the pattern would be there, and the black hole in the middle would be there, which I predicted from my theory there was going to be a black hole at the center of all galaxies long before they found it, that there was. But imagine that this pattern is occurring, and it's just like in your tub when you pull the plug. You know, it makes that swirling pattern. Well, if you have a rubber ducky in your tub, the rubber ducky would start swirling. Well, you know, when there's enough star, when there's enough dust, when there's enough material around that pattern in the space, then all of a sudden the galaxy becomes apparent, you know, but that the pattern of the galaxy is actually in the space. When we start to understand that, that, you know, it's the Coriolis effect of the structure of the of space and time that produces this effect, the dark matter issue disappears, and you know, the dark energy issue and so on. So I think that's the answer there.
Okay, next up we go to Los Angeles, California. Andrew, always a pleasure. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yes, George, you're a great patriot, and we really appreciate you very much here. The question is this. First of all, your guest, what he's saying, he's brilliant, and what he's saying is resonating with me. And many years ago, real quickly, I spoke to Dr. J. Allen Hynek, and I asked him what the chances are of there not being life on other planets. And his answer was quite simply impossible. My question to you, sir, is, in your opinion, if we unlock the secrets of matter and the secrets of the universe and some what some people call infinity, this infinite power in the universe, which man seems to want to unravel and maybe tap into, do you think that we will be able to handle the new world that is coming if we do, in fact, unlock those secrets? And how far off are we from unraveling those secrets? Also, what do you think of the crop circles? What are they trying? What's the origin and what are they trying to say? And thank you.
Well, you know, those are good questions. I think that, you know, if we don't unravel these secrets, we're probably not going to make it. You know, we're reaching the capacity of our planet to sustain us. We're encountering many, many different issues, and our society is in deep need for a new, you know, way of doing things and an alignment with the forces of nature. Will we be able to handle it? Well, you know, people say, well, you know, why don't you think that we would destroy ourselves and so on? Well, you know, like people think of human beings as being fundamentally warlike and so on. I think that when you reach these levels, when you reach this level of technology and understanding, and you attach your society to the fundamental forces of nature, the first thing you realize when you write these equations, when you understand this, you know, philosophy, is that everything is connected and that you have an influence on the universe and so on. And that brings you to this infinite potential of energy and so on. Then many of the stressors that produces the wars and the dispute over land, the dispute over energy and all this, that goes away because all of a sudden you have, you know, almost infinite amount of energy. You probably can eventually produce gravitational drives, and you can fly around at least the solar system. You know, you have all sorts of goods out there. I mean, if you go to the asteroid belt, you know, there's all sorts of chunks of metal and all this, the size of continents and stuff. You know, I mean, there's like all sorts of things. You can, you know, all sorts of space, all sorts of exploration that can be done. All of a sudden, these stressors that produces war are the thought that there is limited amount of space and limited amount of goods. And as soon as that opens up, the tendency to war most likely reduces very much so. So I think that's one of the answer. How soon? I would say very soon. I would say right around the corner. I think we're very, very close. I think, you know, that our society as a whole is actually being prepared for this. I think that this amazing orchestration, this organization you were talking about, George, that nothing is occurring by chance, mm-hmm. but that there's an organizing agent, that we're just at that crest when, you know, we're asked to transform our ideas of competition to ideas of collaboration, to realize that there's infinite amount of goods, that there is, you know, meaning that there's infinite potential and so on, and that, like, this transformation is occurring, and that the science that is going to follow with this transformation is arriving very, very quickly. As far as crop circles go, you know, many, many crop circles are done by people. That doesn't necessarily make them invalid. I mean, people do get inspired, and, you know, what they may draw in a field may have some actually, you know, fundamental universal significance, whether they know it or not. However, some of the crop circles seems to come from unknown source. At the beginning of the show, I was saying that, You know, there's been modern evidence of things flying around, and certainly modern evidence of these things flying around where crop circles are found. And so, you know, I don't know. If you were an advanced civilization and you went to another planet that was kind of low on the totem pole and you wanted to help them kind of evolve a little bit, and you wanted to give them some suggestion that geometry and fractal systems are important and that may be the functioning of the universe and all this, how would you do it? Well, if you can flatten crops pretty easily from far, you could make them nice little drawings, nice little pictures in there, and people would come across it and go, oh, where did that come from? And you know, it would get enough attention that a lot of people would look at it, and it would kind of enter the psyche of the whole society, and eventually maybe you could help them evolve a little faster.
Nassim, what's our planet going to look like over the next 20 years?
Well, I think it's going to look fundamentally different from what it looks like today. It's changing so fast. I mean, how many people 5 years ago or 6 years ago or 8 years ago thought that today we would have an African-American president in the United mm-hmm. States of America? You know, the changes we see everywhere on the planet, you know, there's climatic changes that are occurring and all this. I think that our planet and our society is going through a very fundamental transformation, and what it's going to look like in 20 years is most likely going to be fundamentally different. And not just different, like our computer going to go faster and stuff like that, but actually I think we're going to look back at this period of evolution and think of it as archaic. I believe there's a quantum jump that we're about to make into a new level of consciousness, but at the same time, a new level of technology. You know, many of these ancient civilizations talked about this time as the time of ascension. I believe it's literally. We're going to ascend because we're going to actually understand gravitational field and get off the surface.
Nassim Haramein on Coast to Coast AM, theresonanceproject.org. Thank you so much. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lone Hood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.